From the heartland in north central Indiana, it's the Insurgent Radio Network with Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, broadcasting live from the bunker in Warsaw, Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to drink, sometimes eat. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. You can address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the Insurgent, or just old plain box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
That's right. That's where you'll find me, in that little old box 401. Yeah, let me turn this volume down a little bit. A little bit there. Maybe it's a little bit too high. I don't know. Sometimes I don't know. My engineer's drunk, asleep over here in the corner. Can't wake him up. No, this is a one-man band deal here. What you hear is what you get. And I know sometimes it gets a little screwed, but you can live with it. The main thing is the information. And it is the March the 25th, 2014, and this is Thursday, and normally we'd have Stray Dog on here, but Stray Dog's on the road, so we'll have him back on here next Tuesday. All right. Well, I was just going over my latest information from Minister Farrakhan up there with the black Muslims. Somebody up there in Chicago sends me that newspaper every month. And he's got the whole skinny on flying saucers in this issue. So we're going to have to go all over that, because I'm sure that Mr. Farrakhan's got an inside track on this flying saucer stuff, I'm telling you. Boy, he puts out one hell of a paper. It was about 40 pages in living color, yeah. And about half of it's political, racial, black, and oh my God stuff. And the other half is, I'll be the representative of the great high Father God or whatever, Muhammad, you name it, I'm telling you. He does a lot of self-promotion, that's for sure. You know, I've told you many times, and I'm going to tell you again, that when the crap really hits the fan, the build-up to that hitting the fan is going to be economic. And you can check down through history, behind the scenes or in front of the scenes or beside the scenes or whatever, every major eruption in a country starts, at least in part, through economics. It won't start through race, but after the economic upheaval starts, then people, after a little while, begin to choose up sides and so forth. And now they may be in different groups, and they may decide to cooperate with each other, but in the beginning it'll be smaller groups, and they'll be deciding on which way they're going to go. So that's one reason I put what I think is interesting stuff out here on economics and the environment and, of course, warfare, because these things have a tremendous effect on you and me. And you can't just get on here and talk about one thing. You can't just talk about, oh, those niggers, they're just nigger boarding me every day. And you can't just talk about those Jews are everywhere, they're running everything, because number one, that's not true. There's a lot of them in high position, a lot of them in high power, but trying to say the Jews run everything, that's you're making them into something they're not. They're not near as powerful in many ways. They've got many Achilles heels too. And the blacks, sure, black crime's a problem. Other than that, we just want separation from them, and they can go about their business wherever we make an agreement on where they're going to be. So I think we'll run some, I'm going to run something. Now, this was put out on RT, Russia Today, maybe from a few days ago, maybe a week ago or so. But anyhow, it was on this morning, and it's about that Exxon Valdez ship that hit the rocks up there in Alaska and really destroyed the whole coastline for 1,000 miles. It's still not cleaned up. And the biggest problem was BP. Exxon had their share of guilt, but not as much as BP. And BP is the same ones that turned right around and did the same thing in the Gulf of Mexico. And your federal government's letting them get away with stuff. And so they're trying to tell everybody, oh, everything's wonderful, everything's okay now, but you can go up there to Alaska on that coastline and you'll see that still there's a tremendous amount of oil and problems with the birds and the seals are being born blind and everything else. And Greg Pallas, who is sort of an investigative reporter, he's going to explain a few things to you here. So you stand by and I'll put this on my old radio station. Now, I didn't get this started right at the very beginning, but pretty close. So you'll get most of the good information.
At go to GregPallas.com, you'll see it. You stick your hand in the gravel at Knight Island. This is 25 years after the Exxon Valdez spill. And I did this with a glove on, and you come up with crude. It smells like a rotten gas station. The oil's all over the place. When there's a storm, the sheens come out. The seals are still going blind from that stuff, the ones that return. The birds still get caught and they die. The natives who live there, and are supposed to live, and they used to live off the razor clams and the wildlife there, you know, now they're bringing in canned food. In fact, Exxon was very kind. They brought them seal food, which was meant for zoos.
Oh,
and
my.
So, you know, it's still there. The damage is still there. The damage to the wildlife is still there. The oil's still in those rivulets, in the islands, all throughout the Prince William Sound. And just like it is in the Gulf, they've already declared the Gulf that nature's taking care of everything. That nature's just a happy toilet, and you just poop in it, you flush it, and it's gone. That's not how it works.
I can't help but think if these peer-reviewed scientific studies were paid for by Exxon Valdez, we know how they like to do that. Greg,
actually, they are.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Yeah, just what's happened is that BP and Exxon created these funds, and they have a tremendous control over who does these so-called peer-reviewed studies. Who are the peers? I can tell you that the former chairman of the biology department at the University of Alaska, Rick Steiner, who is the top oil pollution expert on the planet, has said the damage is still there. I was with him. I talked to him about it. And because he's insisted that the damage is still there, and he picks it up in his hand and shows it to you, and he says, we'll be here another 40 years. Because he said that publicly, he got fired. He lost his job as the chairman of the biology department in Alaska.
So let's get to the heart of this really quick, Greg. How does BP fit into the Exxon Valdez disaster? Because obviously people only correlate Exxon to the spill.
Well, we think of the Exxon Valdez disaster as Exxon's problem because they were dumb enough to have their name on the ship, which has now been changed to the Sea River Mediterranean. But BP, and I was the chief investigator of fraud charges then for the people that owned the shoreline. In my investigation, I found it was BP, British Petroleum, which is more responsible than Exxon. I won't let Exxon off the hook. But, you know, tankers run aground. Oil spills. But it's containing it. You don't have to have a tanker leak oil and it goes and it destroys 1,000 miles of coastline. It was British Petroleum that was in charge of making sure that oil never left the area of the ship. It's not rocket science. Basically, you put a rubber on it and you suck. You put this rubber boom around the ship, a big rubber skirt. You can make it miles long. And then you take skimmer ships with hoses and you suck the oil out. It's not rocket science. And in fact, the Exxon Valdez hit at Bligh Reef. British Petroleum had promised in writing, under oath, that they would have a skimmer ship, that they would have the equipment right there at Bly Island. It was as if you had started a fire in front of a fire department. It should have been completely contained, no damage. But in fact, BP had lied. They lied under oath. They lied in writing. They never placed the equipment there. They said it was there, and it wasn't there. And that's only the beginning of the tragedy. BP was also supposed to have a full-time emergency response team. It's just like those barges are like fire trucks. You don't have a city without a fire truck. You don't run tankers without the barge, which is like the fire truck in an emergency. And you can't have fire trucks without a fire crew. The natives of the Prince William Sound, the Chugach natives, had been trained, and they'd been hired and trained to be the emergency response crew. They knew how to put out that rubber. They knew how to run the skimmers. They could they could jump out of helicopters into that water and handle the whole thing. They knew what to do. But they were watching from Tetitlik Village. They were on the beach watching this tanker come in. They were helpless because they'd all been fired by BP to save money. Their equipment was taken away. They had no emergency equipment with them. They were the only trained crew. BP actually made up fake lists of emergency workers who didn't exist. They had phantom equipment, phantom crew, and
this
even
insane,
more tragic.
Right?
Natives watched the ship come in.
So you're saying on paper, they had all of these things that they were supposed to do legally. They evaded all of them just to save money, right? It seems like these people were blocked and thwarted in every way to pursue adequate cleanup efforts, including threats, phone tapping, and bribery. Can you expand on some of the dirtiest of the tricks BP used during the time to stifle the narrative?
Well, for example, the captain at Valdez Port said, if there's a spill out in the middle of the sound, which is exactly where the Exxon Valdez hit, he told BP, if we have a crack up in the middle of the sound, you don't have the equipment that's required to be there. And he wrote this in a letter. That was Captain James Woodall. He was then fired, and they showed him, and if he wanted to complain, they showed him a file of his supposed marital infidelities, completely fabricated. And then they told him, we're going to take away your entire pension unless you destroy your files and your complaints. That was Captain James Woodall. I happen to get a hold of the so-called destroyed files. I have them. The other is that the shipping broker, Charles Hamill, who was helping them arrange to get the oil out of Valdez, was so panicked about the dangers because they didn't have the equipment out there that he took the Concord. He's a wealthy man. He took the Concord to London to talk to the chief executives of BP in London because he thought it was such an emergency that they do something. This is before the Exxon Valdez hit the rocks. And their response was to hire ex-CIA spooks, break into his home, tap his phone, read his mail, and then when he was meeting with a congressman, Congressman George Miller, in a building in Washington, they actually ran a toy truck with a microphone through the air conditioning vents so that they could eavesdrop illegally on a conversation between the whistleblower and the congressman. Unfortunately for them, they also were eavesdropping on a team of Navy SEALs that then arrested these guys.
Greg, this is outrageous. I mean, we know now BP's hiring trolls online to threaten and harass its critics of the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, but I mean, why would they go through such great lengths instead of just adequately cleaning up the spill? I mean, it seems like it would backfire ultimately, but of course no one's talking about it, as we know today.
It's the cash, Abby. It's the cash. And which is that it really costs billions of dollars a year to run a safe system. You know, it costs millions and millions of dollars to have barges, full-time spill response teams. But for the same reason we have fire trucks at the ready in a city, the reason why we have firemen is that there are fires. And you have to spend the money just in case. You have to have that equipment. BP found it easier to pretend that the equipment existed because who's going to look out there in the Prince William Sound? Who's going to look in the Gulf of Mexico? Who cares? So I have to tell you, when I looked at the Deepwater Horizon blowing up, and I watched those flames coming out of that rig, and there's all these fire ships spritzing water on an oil fire, I said, where's the containment boom? Where are the skimmer ships? They had the same exact plan in the Gulf of Mexico as they had in Alaska, and just like Alaska, it was a phantom. It didn't exist. So that when, for example, there was no reason why the Deepwater Horizon oil had to go over 600 miles of Gulf coastline. All they had to do was surround the thing with this rubber boom. The Navy had 400 miles of the stuff, but BP did not have the boom, just like in Alaska. And the reason they got away with it in Alaska, and remember, I was on the legal team, we had no choice. We were told, if you even mention the F word, fraud, you'll never get a penny from us. BP got away with paying all the natives, all the fishermen, the government, everyone, paid $125 million, 100% of that from their insurance fund. So BP got away with the damage that they created in Alaska. So obviously they thought, hey, if we got away with it in the Exxon Valdez breakup, why can't we get away with it in the Gulf? So that's why they didn't have the equipment in the Gulf either.
Greg, I just don't understand. I mean, you're saying who would look in and make sure that these are, you know, safety precautions are being met? The government! I mean, if you're going to be taking these insane risks, deep water drilling, putting tankers out in the middle of the Arctic, for God's sake, I would hope that there would be some sort of oversight, Greg. And of course, no lessons were learned from the Exxon Valdez spill. Here we go with Deepwater Horizon once again. As you mentioned, Obama just authorized BP to return to drill in the Gulf this month. What is it going to take to hold these corporations accountable for poisoning the planet? Greg, we have about a minute left.
Well, I mean, in the case of the government oversight, the Minerals and Mining Service, which was in charge of watching what was happening in the Gulf, they were taking bribes from BP, you know, Super Bowl tickets, small stuff, and some of the executives of BP were having intercourse, some of it monetary, some of it sexual, with the government agents. I kid you not. That's why Obama shut it down, but he shut it down, that agency, after the Deepwater Horizon exploded. And when good government regulators, like a guy, Dan Lawn, who was in charge of regulating Exxon and BP in Alaska, complained before the Exxon Valdez hit the rocks. He said, these guys are making up stuff. There's no real emergency teams.
Unreal.
They had him fired.
Unreal, Greg. Thank you for bringing the culprits out of the shadows into the light. Time to hold these people accountable for their crimes. Greg Pallas, everyone check out your new report. Excellent work. Thank you so much for coming on.
Well, there you go. The skinny on that. And let's see here. See, the problem is we got many problems and for the white race, and it affects everything, the environment, the economy, warfare, all this stuff. And so it's not just our job to keep an eye on and do what we can about the one issue or two issues with black crime, Mexican crime, the Mexican invasion, and the Jews in high places manipulating. But we got to keep an eye on this other stuff too. And when you see very serious attacks on the environment, you know, like people dumping stuff in the rivers and lakes and all that kind of stuff, it's your duty as a white racial separatist to do something about it. And so... it's not just we got to watch out for blacks and the black crime, or Jews and the Jew crime. Sometimes they get mixed up together, but the point is we got other things that are equally important that all run into the same river. Now, I don't know whether you heard about this fiasco with Michelle. Yes, the First Lady. over to China. Now, you know, this trip was not anything to do with the government at all. She just wanted to go to China and take her mammy with her and take her kids with her. It had nothing to do with anything political. Usually when a president goes to another country, there's business involved also, but not in this case. She's being put up at to the tune of $8,000 a night in one of the swankiest hotels in China. And she's got an entourage of 70 people. And the people who work in the hotel say she's a bitch. They don't like her. Can you imagine that? Now, of course, $8,000 a night, I don't think that covers the... 70 people. Now maybe that's extra. unless she's got them sleeping in cars or something, or at a cheap motel across the street. So it just shows you how it gets, and whether they're white or black, they all get into that vein of spending as much money as they can. I think it's going to take two Air Force Ones to get them back and forth. Somebody put out a documentary that Michelle is a man. I don't know whether you've seen that yet, but it's pretty well put together. But it's pretty wild, and explains that she's pretending to be a woman. Well, we do know that Larry Sinclair up there in Chicago, the homosexual who had sexual relations with Obama, and they snorted cocaine together and everything else, so he swears up and down that Obama's bisexual. So if he's bisexual, I don't know. Do you think that's possible for Michelle or Michael to get away with that? Anyhow, the story on the internet, it's pretty convincing. I saw a very good film the other night. It's called The Fifth Estate, and it's about Julian Assange and the WikiLeaks program, and also somewhat about Manning too, who helped this latest dump of tremendous amount of information. But it shows you the trials and tribulations that the guy's gone through to do what he did. And then, of course, they show his foibles, too, and his arrogance and so forth like that. But they didn't go after him too bad for that. It was generally quite a good movie. So you can get it at your local video store. I'm not sure whether it's on Netflix yet or not. I don't think it's going to get real wide distribution because it makes him look pretty good. That, again, is The Fifth Estate. Well, some interesting things are happening over there in the Ukraine this morning or yesterday, and when this nationalist, so-called nationalist right-wing leader got gunned down by the cops. However, you don't know for sure what the story is on that, but these guys are the ones that are siding with the EU and also allowing Jews at the top of the deal in this situation. Maybe not in his group, but in the government, with the premier being Jewish. Let's listen to what they say over here on RT.
Now, this is the body of Alexander Muzichka, shot dead while resisting arrest by Ukrainian police. A violent end to a life that was marked by his militancy, intimidation, and radical nationalism. He was the local leader of the neo-Nazi group Right Sector and was prominent in the violent coup that forced President Yanukovych from power. Now, with more details about his death, here's RT's Alexei Yaroshevsky, who joins me here in the studio. Alexei, good to see you again. Further developments, what's the latest?
Well, we know that Muzichka died as a result of a gunfight when police raided a cafe in the western Ukrainian city of Rovno, where he and his friends were having a dinner. The gunfight started. Muzichka actually jumped from the window, tried to fight back at the police. Just minutes later, he was shot dead by the policeman, who clearly said that, the Interior Ministry said that he was resisting arrest and he was shooting back at the police. It may have seemed just as a regular crime-fighting episode in the life of Ukraine, but if we consider the words of Muzichka himself, he published about 10 days ago online, that he actually predicted his death. Let's have a listen.
The General Prosecutor's Office has ordered the Interior Ministry to remove its political opponents. They plan to start with me. They'll either do the killing themselves or capture me alive and hand me over to the Russian Special Services and let them do it.
Well, not only the manner of his death, but also information we have received from RIA Novosti agency, which quoted a source within the security service, the SBU, which is definitely not the Interior Ministry, but a separate body, which said that it was never a plan to arrest Muzichka, it was a plan to execute him. Whether this suggests internal fighting within the people who actually ousted the previous regime is still a question, but here's where it gets more interesting. Official representative of the right sect in Western Ukraine has just informed the local agencies that the right sector in Western Ukraine will retaliate to the Interior Ministry of Kharkiv personally for the death of Alexander Muzichka. They all but declared war on the Interior Ministry.
Well, why would the Interior Ministry have reason to go after him in this way?
Just to give you an idea what kind of man Muzichka was, I'll give you a quote from the 90s when he was fighting on the side of Chechen militants in Chechnya against Russians. Back then he said on camera that he would, until blood runs through his veins, he would kill Russians, Jews and communists. He certainly was a violent man, but even if we take the past several months, he crossed many lines within Ukraine. He stormed sessions of local administrations, he threatened people with guns, he even made direct threats to the Interior Ministry himself. Let's listen to one of his most popular videos online.
No one tells us when to bear arms and when not to. You didn't give them to us, and you won't take them away. You want to take away my gun? You want to take away my rifle? You want to take away my knife? You come here and take it. The right sector's fighters are ready. I will destroy anyone who comes here. I will hang the Interior Minister Avakov like a dog.
Well, of course, Alexei, this isn't the only instance of his violent behaviour in front of the cameras. There was a recent incident, wasn't there, when he stormed into a local prosecutor's office in western Ukraine, demanding to see the official. Let's see how he dealt with the young employee that he found there.
So that's what Alexander Muzichka was like. Of course, I was surprised to see him at Independence Square, although it was quite understandable that some part of the protesters there were hardline nationalists. And Muzichka, of course, wasn't the most dangerous one there. The biggest question right now is, provided this latest statement coming from right sect in Western Ukraine, that they all but declared war on the Interior Minister, whether this could escalate into something more violent than we have already seen.
Alexei, thank you very much. RT's Alexei Yaroshevsky.
Now, I just got a report in from the Russian area from one of our contacts who says that one of the conditions for the IMF loans, apparently, was to get rid of this group that actually helped drive the other president out of the country. I expect to see more of this as those Zionistic cosmopolitan and financier bankster element in real power assert themselves, perhaps even a purge. So it looks like there's going to be a lot of trouble there in the Ukraine, not really caused by the Russians at all. Well, I tuned into Max Kaiser this morning. He had a pretty good piece on there, so let's go see what Max is up to on the economy. And remember, when he talks about Britain, it's almost like talking about the United States, because they sort of run parallel.
Said, when confronted with the fact that he got his maths wrong, instead he doubled down on stupid, just like they all do, because the taxpayer always picks up the bill for stupid, don't they? Stacey.
Apparently they do for both our cold wars, our hot wars, and apparently our wars on the population, financial war on the population. And by the way, I did notice that you said maths properly instead of math.
Yeah, like, because all those the British people would write in and say, oh, it's pronounced maths, not math. Of course, in America we say math, we don't say maths. English don't have to speak American.
Well, remember back in December 2010, they introduced a new top-up fee. It used to be called a top-up fee when it was £1,000 a year, but then it went to £3,000 a year. And then in December 2010, they said this was a time of austerity, and they introduced £9,000 a year, and there were huge protests across the UK. Well, student fees policy likely to cost more than the system it replaced. The proportion of graduates failing to pay back student loans is increasing at such a rate that the Treasury is approaching the point at which it will get zero financial reward from the government's policy of tripling tuition fees to £9,000 a year. So the new official forecast is that 45% of the £10 billion per year in student loans will not be paid, and that's likely to rise to 48% soon.
Yeah, back in 2010, was it, when they introduced the top-up fee? £5,000 a year to help out, paying education, right?
That well, no, concept? Actually, the £1,000 a year was like 9 years ago, and then it moved up to £3,000 per year, and it tripled to £9,000 in 2010, which was 4 years ago.
Okay. I remember back, though, when we first covered this, when it was de minimis, top-up fee for UK students. At the time, I said, okay, this is going to open the door for escalation. This is what happens when you privatize something that should not be privatized, in this case, education. So it's a way for debt sellers to sell more debt, to load up consumers, in this case, students, with debt, because students didn't have enough debt. Forget that it kills your education in the country. That's not the point. The point is to wongify your education system, and students hadn't been loaded up with debt. So take all the students and you load them up with debt until they can't pay the debt anymore. Like a pinata, you whack them to death with debt. Now, who's going to be next on the socioeconomic ladder to be loaded up with debt? I think in this country it's going to be fetuses. They're going to load up fetuses with debt, and then fetuses are going to abort themselves to avoid prenatal bankruptcy. That's what we look forward to here in this country, because the debt mongers are not going to be satisfied with just killing one generation. They want to kill the next generation.
Back to this policy here, it's pure abuse. It's just for abuse, because it actually costs the government more than just charging £3,000 a year, and also locking out a lot of poor people, because they're even though you don't have to pay, start paying back the loan until you earn £21,000, it still discourages poor people who think, well, £9,000 still sounds a lot to be in debt.
Well, how do you square the circle? Let's jump in here for a second, because in other words, you're saying it's economically unfeasible to foist all this debt onto the students who now can't pay the debt. So the entire process was completely economically a failure. So where does it go? Well, the UK national debt is now £1.25 trillion and growing quite rapidly, as all of these failed programs are just thrown onto the bonfire of national debt.
So the government's losing money, but what does it do to these people who are unable to pay their loans? Of course, it gives them bad credit and therefore forever puts them in a system where they're 30 years a slave, okay? You're 30 years a slave to these government loans, these student-backed, these student loans. You can never escape them until 30 years. So theoretically, it's hanging over your head for 30 years. You also have a lower credit rating, which gives you a higher interest rate on your credit cards, on your loans for your house, your mortgage, therefore make you even more of a slave.
You're on the wrong side of the interest rate apartheid wall. And you're suffering under the burden of high interest rates, but the people who are selling you the debt are able to borrow money at near 0% interest. And they're able to consume borrowing money at near 0% interest. They're jacking up inflation, but it doesn't matter for them because they're borrowing money at near 0% interest. You're on the wrong side of the interest rate apartheid wall, so you pay high interest and higher rates of interest for your student debt, which you can't pay back. It lowers your student rate, your credit rating, and therefore your cost of debt even goes higher. Oh, by the way, let's start a new war somewhere. We'll send you as a soldier to go pay off your debt. That's ultimately the plan for this coalition government, is to get rid of deadbeat debtors and students. You say, we'll just send you to Ukraine, send you to Russia, send you to someplace else, send you to Afghanistan, send you to the war on terror hoax, and you'll get dead, and then we'll write you off. So more UK soldiers dead for Wonga. Right on, UK soldiers, die for Wonga, because you deserve it in this country. Cup of tea.
Yeah, no, but it's even more than Wong. If these people can't even pay back loans with only a 4% interest rate on it, this is how bad it is. And now, you know, it reminds me of, I remember going to America about 10 years ago, and I hadn't been there for a while, and I was sitting at my mother's house, bored in Connecticut, looking through the Hartford Current, and there were ads, the Help Wanted ads, and like McDonald's looking for, you had to have a bachelor's degree, you had to have a college education in order to get a job at McDonald's. I thought, wow, this is crazy. Well, the same thing has emerged here, and this is why people can't pay back their loans. Lower pay for young adults, an oversupply of those with degrees, and the worsening economic outlook have all contributed to the revised civil service forecast, which conclude that far fewer graduates will earn enough to pay back their loans over their working lives. 4 months ago, Willits notified Parliament that the rate had risen to 40% from 35%. In 2010, the estimate was 28%. When they started this, they said 28% wouldn't be able to pay it back over the 30 years. Now it's up to 40%. Now it's 45%. And soon it's going to be 48.6%.
And they are going to end up in prison. where they are privatizing the prisons to go with the privatized education and the privatized health service and the privatized energy business and the privatized transportation system. And you have the privatized prison business, and people end up in prison, debtors' prison, the workhouse. They already had the model here in the UK going back, 150 years or so. They had the workhouse. Now they're going to have the branded workhouse. It'll be McDonald's workhouse. It'll be Wonga's workhouse. And, they'll sell it as something that people are just dying to get into, and they want to be in the workhouse to pay off their apartheid debt that was foisted upon them by the City of London in cahoots with Mayor Boris Johnson, George Osborne, David Cameron, and the whole list of sleaze bags.
So here their forecasts are now looking forward to 2042. Of the £200 billion to be taken out in student loans by 2042, $90 billion won't be paid back because these people won't earn more than £21,000 per year. So that's telling you out into the future. And now you look at that in terms of the housing bubble here. Like you're always going to be earning only 10% of what house prices are.
That's part of the apartheid system in the UK, using interest rates instead of absolute walls or the apartheid wall, over Israel-Palestine. Here in the UK, they use the interest rate wall to separate the folks that they're trying to systematically annihilate through economic terrorism versus the people that they're our friends who will support their wars overseas, the people who support criminality in Whitehall, the people who support criminality in the city. Those people are protected.
Apparently, David Willetts was on Channel 4 News, and we have a tweet here from one of the hosts of Channel 4 News says, as David Willetts was leaving the studio, I suggested it sound like another tuition fees rise was on the way. Could be, was his response. So here they're doubling down. As you say, he should have said, oops, my bad, the maths are wrong. Let's cut it back down to £3,000 a year for the tuition fees per annum here in the UK. Instead, he's like, nope, we're going to double down. We're going to increase the fees. We're already losing 48.6%. 48.6%.
But they have to double down. They have to double down to feed the broken model. The economic failure has to be doubled down. And where they make it up is on the national debt. The debt in this country will continue to go higher. There's no plan to get rid of the debt.
There's no plan to get rid of the debt. Now, again, 48.6% cannot pay back these loans because they don't earn over £21,000 per year. Now this headline, London house prices jump by £50,000 in a month. So houses here in London, a freaking house made of cement, bricks and mortar, and it is smarter, more productive than some chump who spends years at university learning and trying to educate himself or herself. And a house is more productive than a stupid person going to university. Rightmove said the average asking price in London rose to £544,232 in October from £493,748 the month before, an increase of more than 10%. Across England and Wales, the rise over the month was a more modest 2.8% to £252,418.
Right, and of course that rise in house price is not considered inflationary, because the government will include in their inflation figures slave-made goods sold at Primark, sold in factories in Bangladesh that collapse and kill people, and those prices are down, and so that's what they look at, and they say, look, there's no inflation. House prices obviously are indicating hyperinflation, but they don't look at that. They don't include that. They say, no, that's an asset. That's not in our basket. We don't look at it. And so that's how they use, again, statistical obfuscation to put forward this extraordinarily damaging system of interest rate apartheid.
So you've had ZERP, QE, funding for lending, help to buy, and you've also had the money laundering through here, through the City of London. This is what has resulted in the house price rises. But the same problem with interest rate rises, what happens with that when that happens, and jobs and income. And this is in the final quote here, there are also concerns about how those using help to buy will cope with repayments once interest rates rise, currently at a record low. Rightmove hinted at the problem of mortgage affordability in the capital, saying the government scheme is, quote, of no benefit to many Londoners for whom the income to service a mortgage is a greater challenge than the deposit required. Basically, as you see, £544,000 is the average price now in London. That's because it's going to go to £600,000 because that's what the government will put 20% down for you. But as Rightmove is pointing out, if you don't have the income to service the rest of it, it doesn't matter.
No, and plus property taxes are on the rise. Mm. So the people will be forced out of their homes with rising property taxes. So again, you've got a system as pernicious as the South African apartheid system, except here in the UK they use interest rates. Stacey, thanks so much once again for enlightening us with all of these incredibly detailed and well thought out factoids.
Okay.
Stay tuned.
Well, thank you, Max. You know, most of that stuff, even though it was talking mostly today about Britain, it's the same thing going on over here. But did you see that amazing houses in London are going up $50,000 at a whack in just a few days or weeks? Oh boy, talk about inflation. Well, I get to represent you this evening at a speech by a Holocaust survivor. And community members are invited to hear Ava Kaur's first-person account of surviving Auschwitz concentration camp and the medical experiments of Dr. Joseph Mengele on Eva and her twin sister Miriam. Though her childhood experiences were dark and tragic, Kaur's courage and her decision to forgive those who murdered her family and abused her will inspire people. Now, this is all for these Christian Zionist nuts around here. The event, the Eva Kaur story, Surviving the Holocaust, will be March 25th at 6 p.m. at the Manhattan Orthopedic Capital Center at Grace College in Winona Lake, which is a Christian college, and this is a big corporation, this orthopedic outfit. They even give a lot of money to the SPLC. The event is free. Admission will be granted on first-come basis. Seating capacity is 2,500. There you go. And also a local tax-supported county, Kosciuszko County Community Foundation is sponsoring this event. So this means that they're forking over quite a bit of money for this broad to speak. Well, I'd like to have one question answered. I just want an estimate on how many bodies were actually cremated in these camps where they say they had crematoriums. That's all I want to know, because state-of-the-art back then was about 7 hours to totally cremate a body, according to my information. So then all we have to do is use simple math to see how long it would take. And it's astronomical. We're talking about years and years. So anyhow, that's where I'll be spending my evening. That'll be thrilling. And I know I'll be as welcome as a proverbial turd in a punch bowl. Well, I've got a new project here, boys and girls. My kids chipped in together and bought me a new computer. And it's Microsoft 8. I guess you can expand it to 8.1. I don't know what that's all about. So that's going to be another problem for me to figure out, because every time I change operating systems, believe me, it gets tough. Oh yes, thanks JNR. We received your donation and we'll see to it that it gets put to the right uses. Had a nice letter yesterday from Matt Hale, in which he was thanking us for sending him some money and also sending him some books. I sent him two or three books in the last month, which he was quite happy to get. Well, let's close out the show with some readings from the great book Siege. How about that? And of course, that's by James Mason. This is entitled Stupid People. Stupid people are more dangerous than any time bomb. You'll find stupid people everywhere, but let us confine ourselves to those within the movement itself. those whom we must deal with on a regular basis. Those armies of idiots within the system bureaucracy stand backed up and reinforced by so many replacements that errors of judgment on their part, which would otherwise prove fatal, are usually quickly caught and reversed before any real damage gets done. This looks familiar. I hope I didn't read this before. Oftentimes they are caught and squelched before anyone not part of the bureaucracy can even take note of them. It gives the aura of invisibility, but in fact provides for a deadly defect in that everyone is depending on everyone else to carry things through. There are plenty of Sharpies within the system, but not the same kind as that are found in revolutionary movements, those that can do it all for themselves. The system needs their stupid people for errand boys, and so on. While we just cannot afford their presence at all, with us things must stand or fall with just you and I, and that is the basis of real responsibility. Regardless whether they are with you or against you, stupid people are equally disastrous to have around. It's easy for anyone to imagine how stupid people can foul up the best plan or program and defeat the efforts of dozens of good and prudent people with whom they have associated themselves. But it's less easily understood what it means to have fools for adversaries. Again, I emphasize that we are dealing with the limits of the movement itself, or I call it the struggle. I'd much rather run the risk of a tactical personal setback at the hands of a sharp, intelligent person, something I would expect I could reverse in time, than to have everything, the whole ball of wax, upturned or destroyed by some flake who loses all better judgment and control. The very reason one falls out with persons of limited intelligence usually involves the same lack of vision, imagination, and discipline that will later lead them to tip the balance over from a localized clash to a full-scale disaster, too often involving the system and threatening to destroy or seriously injure both participants. It's also hell to try to second-guess an unintelligent person. They're largely unpredictable and are liable to do anything. An intelligent adversary can most of the time be anticipated, and if not, it usually means that he is a jump or two ahead of you himself. He can be expected to fight things with at least the protection, if not the immediate furtherance, of the cause in mind. A stupid individual won't care. They can see or understand nothing beyond the immediate object of, quote, I'll show you, unquote. How often have we witnessed this in the right-wing dealings? How often have we seen it in personal affairs, and how the pigs laugh at it all? Within the struggle, whenever a person like this is uncovered and proceeds to threaten to disrupt things, he probably should be killed before any damage could be done. If that is not feasible, then it is critical to place as much distance between them and the struggle as possible. Same goes for personal dealings as well. Of course, in the long run, it's better to learn how to spot them in advance and never let them penetrate to a level where they can do no good and only harm. In this way, we shall forge ourselves into a truly formidable political weapon. And that was from July 1984. The next is brief your people. As we've said often enough in the past, not everyone is a leader type. Not everyone can be expected to do all the thinking all the time. If you're working with others under whatever pretenses, it's a serious mistake to assume they'll be able to think things through and make all the right moves under a sudden and stressful situation, such as a police attack with no preparation. The only best way to prepare for such an event, which you may safely assume will occur sooner or later, is by briefing your people in advance of any contingency. A briefing is just that. It's an all going over aloud of only the essential points involved in any specific situation, only the crucial, critical facts and principles that are known to be involved. I personally have worked miracles through the successful use of briefings. A person totally unfamiliar to a given situation can be made to pass as being intimately familiar with it after a thorough briefing. And a thorough, successful briefing should require no more than 30 minutes time maximum. Any more than that, and you run the risk of confusing your people. At times I have taken people either by car or by foot from one place to places where I have briefed them on essentials and facts. Then that is to be injected after the known indisputable facts have been introduced and established. The key is to remove all confusion and uncertainty, avoid redundancy, and concentrate upon making as many important impressions on the minds of your subjects as possible. Make them acquainted to firsthand by sights and motions only aids in making those impressions. Once they grasp the workings and are aware of the facts, then most anything can be added, including extra events and even extra people. This, of course, comes in most handy when prepping or coaching witnesses before appearing under oath. When getting ready to head off a possible mess involving the law, as in the case concerning a revolutionary circle living and existing outside the legal bounds, briefings made well in advance of any expected investigation or attack and rehearsed periodically, designed to delete certain group activities, are what is required. A successful briefing will never involve an attempted recital of a cut-and-dried script. To be credible and thus be effective in practical use, whether offensively or defensively, one's given story must flow naturally and show all the characteristics of a normal, relaxed situation or conversation. It must never go into direct contradiction of the known facts, but instead merely present an unknown side of the story, basically in agreement with all the others. They must never include easy, readily demonstrable lies. Further, when under investigation or attack by any pig agency of the system, a shrewd individual will know how to brief his people so that the enemy will provide the cues for the prepared stories and answers. To be really successful at briefing people, you must make them able to recognize dangerous or trick questions when they are asked. Most generally, the appropriate answer will be only too obvious. With practice, all involved will get together, get better. Briefing should properly provide what amounts to an instant experience in whatever area it is that you're going into. Its effect should be of building confidence within and robbing the enemy of any element of surprise. I have done this successfully with groups and individuals, with the elderly and with very small children. The object is always the same. Defeat the pig. That's from July 1984 also. Well, we got time for one more little section here. This is entitled Cooler Heads. With even the most minor experiences within struggle circles and activities, you yourself will probably be, in any given outside situation of a tense nature, the coolest head present. Whenever the situation does become heated or aroused in any way, never assume that the other cooler heads will prevail, for to do so runs the risk that the problem may escalate out of control with you being right in the middle. Never forget the number one priority of any revolutionary to maintain to survive at all costs. We can't allow ourselves the luxury of the common anger and resultant outlets which such anger inevitably seeks and finds. If there is no clear-cut advantage to any potential conflict, then stay out of it. Head it off. Avoid it absolutely. Suicide pacts are of no use. Policies of mutual destruction are only feasible where huge resources exist. Punitive measures are currently an unaffordable expense for us. It is a mistake of the most childish sort to abandon the greater, higher goal in favor of pursuing some momentary thing involving some practically meaningless sidetrack. You know, like these guys that want to put on uniforms and march around and risk getting into riots and slugfests and maybe shootouts in the street. Whatever move you make, whether it involves punishing, leaving alone, or even rewarding any person for anything, make sure that it is so calculated that it is you and the movement or the struggle who will ultimately profit from it. And it matters not whether you apply any one of the three options to situations where spur-of-the-moment emotion might want to apply to another. Just so long as you do not shoot yourself in the head, but rather emerge the final beneficiary of your own decision. It is here where the supreme self-discipline is demanded. For the young revolutionary movement or order struggle, the old concept of the Mexican standoff should become well understood. Whenever tangling with an equal or superior force over some tributary or even lesser matter, you should consider yourself to be batting 1,000 if you can walk away from the situation alive, free, and intact, not to mention with the added experience which has cost you nothing. That is a definite victory of sorts. The Mexican standoff, therefore, is about the best we, in our limited and tedious position, can hope for. We must learn to be able to base all decisions and actions accordingly to our own benefit. The time for chest-thumping, false theatrics, and heroics is past. We must act prudently and wisely in each case henceforth if we are to be around and in the position to exercise genuine heroics when the actual day for them arrives. We must continue to survive until that day. Be assured, cooler heads will prevail. It's up to you to make certain that the cooler heads belong to you. And that's again from July 1984, James Mason. Well, that's the show for today, and we'll be back tomorrow, hopefully, on Wotan's Day, Wednesday, unless the Jews happen to get me tonight, or the Christians trample me to death. 14-5.
I was traveling west of Buckskin on my way to a cattle run, across a little cactus desert under a hot blistering sun. I was thirsty down to my toenails, stopped to rest me on a stump, but I tell you I just couldn't believe it when I saw that water pump. I took it to be a mirage at first, it'll fool a thirsty man. Then I saw a note stuck in a bacon powder can. This pump is old, the note began, but she works, so give her a try. I put a new sucker washer in her, you may find the leather dry.
You've got to find the pump, you must have faith and believe. You've got to give of yourself, for you're worthy to receive. Drink all the water you can hold, wash your face, cool your feet.
Yeah, you'll have to prime the pump. Work that handle like there's a fire. Under that rock to find some water I left in a bitter's jar. Now there's just enough to prime it with, so don't you go drinking first. You just pour it in and pump like mad, buddy, you'll quench your thirst.
You've got to prime the pump. You must have faith and believe. You've got to give of yourself, for you're worthy to receive. All the water you can hold, wash your face, cool your feet, beneath the bottle full for others, thank you kindly, desert deep.
Well, Well, I found that jar, and I tell you, nothing was ever prettier to my eye. And I was tempted strong to drink it, cause that pump looked mighty dry. But the note went on, have faith, my friend, there's water down below. You've got to give until you get, I'm the one who ought to know. So I poured in the jar and I started pumping, and I heard a beautiful sound of water bubbling and splashing out of that hole in the ground. I took off my shoes and I drunk my fill of that cool, refreshing treat. I thank the Lord, I thank the pump, and I thank old Desert Pete.
You've got to find the pump, you must have faith and believe. You've got to give of yourself, oh.